Welcome to the Holiness Today podcast. On today's episode, listen to three brief lectures by H. Ray Dunning on Karl Barth, Rudolf Bultmann, and Dietrich Bonhoeffer.
The 20th century is an exciting time to live theologically. There has been such a ferment of activity during this period that numerous writers have spoken of it as a theological renaissance. Some time ago, a pastor friend asked me an interesting and humorous question. Why don't we have any more great theologians like St. Augustine and Martin Luther? It was amusing because there probably has not been a half century in the history of the Christian era which has produced more theological giants than the first 50 years of this century. Perhaps you are asking, what is a great theologian? I would say that he is one who is a seminal thinker, one who achieves new breakthroughs in theological thought, who speaks to his generation with such creative genius that his work becomes the seedbed from which other less creative thinkers draw their inspiration and ideas. There have really been only a few men like this in Christian history. Most of us are doomed to repeat what they have said and to explore the implications of their concepts. One of the unique features of the theologizing which has gone on in our time is its concern for preaching. That is, theology has come out of its ivory tower, at least in intention, and sees its work to be in the service of the church, particularly the proclamation of the church. Alongside this heartening development is the equally disheartening fact that the church, especially in America, has quarantined its theologians from the mainstream of its life. The result, as Norman Porteous so neatly puts it, has been the disturbing paradox of a theologically inarticulate church, content to eke out its existence on a meager diet of theological pablum, surrounded by a veritable galaxy of brilliant and prophetic theological minds. Doubtless the most influential of these great theological voices has been Karl Barth, whose work really began while he was a village pastor struggling with the problem of preaching. Trained in liberal theology, he found it weak at the point of providing authority for preaching, since it drew its understanding of religion from human experience. He described his own problem in these words: I sought to find my way between the problem of human life on the one hand and the content of the Bible on the other. As a minister, I wanted to speak to the people in the infinite contradiction of their life, but to speak the no less infinite message of the Bible, which was as much of a riddle as life itself. Out of this concern, Barth discovered what he called a strange new world within the Bible, which eventuated in the publication of a commentary on the Epistle to the Romans, first issued in 1918. This work, which Barth himself termed a marginal note on theology, turned out to be a veritable bombshell. As another great theologian, Paul Tillich, described it, it was, quote, neither a commentary nor a system, but a prophetic call addressed to religion and culture, to acknowledge the divinity of the divine and to dissolve the neo-Protestant synthesis between God's and man's creativity, end quote. By neo-Protestantism, he means liberalism. With its walls already cracking, theological liberalism was blasted to pieces and all but destroyed by this single writing. In contrast to liberalism, which saw man searching his way to God, Barth declared that Christianity was not a religion, because it was not man seeking God, but rather God seeking man, and the only way that man could come to know God was by God's self-revelation, and this revelation is contained in the Bible. The movement which Barth initiated was variously termed the theology of the Word, dialectical theology, or more familiar, neo-orthodoxy. For those of us interested in preaching the Word, Barth achieved another important result in biblical studies. Before him, most commentaries had been content to deal with critical issues and do what scholars call grammatico-historical exegesis, that is, recovering what the text meant. But Barth called attention to the necessity of a theological exegesis of biblical passages, because this is the authoritative element and provides the basis upon which the preacher makes an authoritative pronouncement on the relevance of the word to his congregation in the present. Since that time, biblical commentaries have been becoming more and more adequate in terms of providing this theological exegesis. Incidentally, it was also the emphasis of Barth on the Scripture which set in motion the forces which have resulted in the explosion of new translations of the Bible with which we are inundated. All are motivated by the concern to bring the Word to the people in their language. My first exposure to Barth's theology was through reading G.C. Berkauer's book, The Triumph of Grace in the Theology of Karl Barth. I was a pastor then, and my training in theology was a little weak, which made it pretty tough going, but I waded through it and learned a great deal. I would suggest a better introduction to Barth's thought might be his own small discussion on the Apostles' Creed entitled Dogmatics in Outline. There you can capture some of the main themes of his theology, such as the sovereignty of God, the centrality of Christ, the relation of theology to the church's task of proclamation, and so on. Perhaps more readily accessible is a small collection of lectures given to an American audience and published under the title Evangelical Theology. Here you get the feeling of Barth as a humorous, joyful, energetic theologian. For the really ambitious, of course, there is Barth's magnum opus, his Church Dogmatics, which extends rather wordily into some 10,000 pages. Barth's theology, obviously, is not above criticism. Christianity Today, for years, carried on a running debate with Barth over his views about the relation of revelation to history, thus showing fundamentalism's uneasiness with some of his formulations and especially his methodology. There are doubtless many points which the Nazarene theologian would want to call into question, but it is nevertheless true that Barth has some important things to say and some helpful things. Personally, I gained a very significant insight while reading his discussion of sanctification in Church Dogmatics, Volume 4, Part 2. There he points out that what is meant by sanctification might just as well be described comprehensively by the term discipleship, which is so outstanding, especially in the Synoptic Gospels. We have a long time been aware that Jesus does not talk about sanctification in the terms to which we are accustomed, which raises the question of how he did talk about it, if he talked about it at all. This provides an answer to that question, and lets me preach on holiness from the Gospels, using Jesus' discipleship sayings, and furthermore, providing really dynamic content to the concept. Barth is eminently quotable. As an example, when his epistle to the Romans created such a stir, he likened himself to a man who was falling in the dark and reached out for support. To his surprise, he found that he had caught a bell rope, and the ringing of the bell had awakened the whole town. Or in commenting on the nature of God's self-revelation, he said, "When God calls, he does not call station to station, but person to person." Or in discussing the relation of the Christian to the world, he suggests that the believer should not antagonize the world, for, as he put it, when Daniel was in the lion's den, he didn't pull the lion's tail. Barth's work may be wordy, but at times it is brilliant, with great insights. Try it. You may like it. A Of all the theologians of the 20th century, probably none has been subjected to more criticism from all quarters than Rudolf Bultmann, the New Testament scholar from the University of Marburg. Yet, in spite of that, he has exercised an extensive influence, especially in terms of the questions which he raised, questions with which his successors are still struggling. Perhaps in our chat today we can point up some positive things along with calling attention to some other matters to see what contributions Bultmann might make to our thinking. In the early days of the 20th century, it was the work of Karl Barth which dominated the theological scene. But as the century progressed, Professor Bultmann almost seemed to usurp Barth's dominance. Returning from a visit to Europe in 1952, Paul Tillich remarked, "When you come to Europe today, it is not as it was before, with Karl Barth in the center of discussion. It is now Rudolf Bultmann who is in the center." While Bultmann shared many of Barth's theological concerns regarding the nature of God and the centrality of the Bible, for example, he diverged from him at least one significant point, a point which gave his theology a radically different character from Barth's. Barth had felt and argued that there was no need to make any special effort to communicate the gospel to the world. In fact, he had insisted that it was impossible to do so on man's part unless God created a point of contact. He did not see one of the functions of the theologian to be building bridges to unbelievers. In his own words, "The best way of dealing with unbelievers is to treat them quietly, simply, as if their rejection of Christianity was not to be taken seriously, remembering that Christ has died and risen also for them." Bultmann took a different stance. For him, the unbeliever must be taken seriously, and an attempt must be made to build a bridge to him. This meant removing the barriers which stand in the way of his acceptance of the Christian message. The biblical way of talking about the legitimate barrier to belief is the scandal or offense of the cross, a phrase which Paul uses in Galatians 5:11. It is Bultmann's concern that the scandal be at the right place, that is, that the unbeliever should not be repelled by the wrong scandal, or to put it another way, that we not place unnecessary stumbling blocks in his way. Thus, Bultmann's theology has been described as seeking the right scandal. With this, I think we might all identify. Certainly, we do not want to raise false barriers to the acceptance of the Christian faith. It is at the point of Bultmann's working out of this concern that we will doubtless find ourselves in radical disagreement. The task of removing the false scandal he calls demythologizing, which, since his work, has become a big word in theological discussion. What does he mean? Well, in order to understand this, we have to first look at his view of modern man. In essence, he contends, 20th century people are informed in their thinking by modern science, which operates on a basic presupposition about nature, which is that all events are susceptible to a this-worldly explanation. That is, no event can be explained as caused by the intervention of supernatural forces. The Bible is filled with such supernatural interventions, such as miracles, demon possession, men rising from the dead, etc. In fact, Bultmann contends, the whole New Testament is written in the light of an outmoded world view which can no longer be accepted by modern man. Specifically, this world view perceives the universe as a three-storied affair, in terms of which the earth is a flat surface, with the sky as a kind of inverted bowl, with heaven above it, and supernatural beings coming down from above, and demonic beings swarming up from below the surface. Now that modern science has shown that space is infinite, the world is round, etc., this picture can no longer be accepted. It is to this worldview especially the aspect of it which explains natural occurrences in terms of divine activity that Bultmann gives the term myth. Demythologizing, then, becomes a task of stripping the New Testament of all these pre-scientific mythological explanations and purported events. Bultmann's critics have attacked him at many points, as we previously noted. At the more sophisticated level, he has been roundly scored for his use of the term myth to refer to this pre-scientific explanations. Myth, his critics say, carries a quite different connotation. More conservative people have usually just been incensed that he has high-handedly stripped all the miraculous elements from the biblical story, including the virgin birth and the resurrection of Christ. And much of this criticism has been rather vitriolic, even though it certainly has been justified. The result of that is that few conservatives have found anything of positive value in Bultmann. But let us see. In the final analysis, Bultmann ultimately reduces the scandal to one point, which he considers the true one. That is, the act of God in Christ. But critics justifiably question this too, by asking on what grounds Bultmann can stop the demythologizing process at that point. If he insists on rejecting divine activity from the sphere of nature as a principle of explanation, is this an arbitrary suspension of his own principle? It would seem that he must go all the way and reject this act too, or simply say that it must be taken on faith, in which case we may ask, why not take the other on faith too? But we need not continue with this criticism. Let's take another look into Bultmann's analysis. He suggests that what the mythological passages of the New Testament are doing is presenting a Christian self-understanding which must be translated into modern terms. Consequently, he searches around for a vehicle by means of which he can bring this self-understanding to expression in contemporary terms. He finds this vehicle in the philosophy of Martin Heidegger, a German existentialist who was his colleague at the University of Marburg. While Heidegger is extremely difficult to understand, even by the professional philosopher, John McQuarrie has written a little book in a series on makers of contemporary theology, published by John Knox Press, which makes him reasonably comprehensible. The truth is, he has some very fruitful insights which Bultmann uses. For example, he talks about authentic and inauthentic existence. This is quite meaningful, in terms of which Bultmann wants to speak of inauthentic existence in terms of life apart from God and authentic existence in terms of something made available to man by the act of God in Christ. If it is true that Heidegger gives us a valid description of contemporary man and his problems, thus stating the human predicament in a way which is relevant to this age, then Bultmann may have a good point in using this as a vehicle through which to give expression of the Christian faith and its redemptive word to the present age. Of course, this is no different from what theologians through all the ages have been doing. St. Augustine chose the philosophy of Neoplatonism. St. Thomas Aquinas utilized the philosophy of Aristotle. In our own tradition, H. Orton Wiley chose the philosophy of absolute idealism as a vehicle to give expression to his doctrine of God. All systematic theology does the same thing. The only question, and it is a technical one, is whether the existential concepts of Heidegger adequately convey the Christian message, or do they distort it? But then again, all theologians face the same problem when they seek to speak in contemporary terms. Another of Bultmann's points, which might be seriously considered, is his view of faith. Here he follows the 19th century theologian Soren Kierkegaard in insisting that faith must be exercised without objective evidence, else it ceases to be faith. This is to say that there are no empirical props to faith, observable phenomena to which one may point, which identify a particular event as an act of God. Thus, the affirmation that God has acted in Jesus Christ is understood properly only when it is understood as a call to the radical decision of faith, by which he means total surrender of the self to God. This, it seems to me, is one of existential theology's strong points, to emphasize the nature of faith as total commitment of the whole person and not just as intellectual response. As Bultmann puts it, for a man to believe the Christian proclamation is at the same time for God to act in the present in that man's death to his old self and resurrection to the life of freedom in love. That stresses a point that our tradition has continued to emphasize, namely, the need for the reality of a present experience of the historical character of God's work, and it is also a truly Pauline emphasis.
The theologian we wish to talk about today did something that few theologians have been called upon to do, become a martyr for his faith. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was killed by the Nazis in 1945 at the age of 39 for participation in a plot to assassinate Hitler. Perhaps you react that I need to justify my statement that he died for his faith. Let me try to do that. Bonhoeffer's theology was Christ-centered, or what is the same thing, incarnational. By that I mean that he was terribly impressed with the fact that Jesus embodied himself in human life. He became radically involved with the world. This is what led him, theologically, to become involved in the resistance movement and becomes, as I want to comment later, the key to much of his theological pilgrimage, which seemed to be a progressive development of the implications of the incarnation for faith and life. As Hitler rose to power, Bonhoeffer almost immediately voiced a protest in a radio broadcast which was cut off before its completion by government monitors. He later resigned his teaching post and went to London to pastor a church, but after 2 years returned to Germany to organize an underground seminary. An incident which occurred there typifies Bonhoeffer's commitment to truth without compromise. Some of his students came to him with a suggestion that it was poor strategy for them to continue to remain outside the Reich Church, thereby losing the chance to occupy the best pulpits and extend their influence more widely. They reminded their professor of all the true sermons they could preach if only they had the proper state credentials. The directness of his reply left little room for argument. One act of obedience, he said, is better than 100 sermons. With the help of American friends, he came to the United States, but his conscience bothered him, and he soon returned home. In a letter to Reinhold Niebuhr, he reveals his true character. I have come to the conclusion, he said, that I have made a mistake in coming to America. I must live through this difficult period of our national history with the Christian people of Germany. I shall have no right to participate in the reconstruction of Christian life in Germany after the war if I do not share the trials of this time with my people. Christians in Germany, he went on, will face the terrible alternative of either willing the defeat of their nation in order that Christian civilization may survive, or willing the victory of their nation and thereby destroying our civilization. I know which of these alternatives I must choose, but I cannot make that choice in security. Thus we can see how Bonhoeffer's powerful little book, The Cost of Discipleship, was no academic exercise. Just as it was costly for God in the Incarnation, it is costly to those who would live out the implications of that Incarnation. In this book, he talked about cheap grace and sharply criticized the modern evangelical church for dispensing grace on such cheap and easy terms that it amounts to the justification of sin without the justification of the sinner. One may reason, he said, like this. I can go on and sin as much as I like, and rely on this grace to forgive me. For after all, the world is justified in principle by grace. I can therefore cling to my bourgeois secular existence and remain as I was before, but with the added assurance that the grace of God will cover me. The upshot of it all is that my only duty as a Christian is to escape from the world for an hour or so on a Sunday morning and go to church to be assured that my sins are all forgiven. I need no longer try to follow Christ, for cheap grace, the bitterest foe of all true discipleship, has freed me from that. The cost of discipleship is one of contemporary theology's most pungent works on sanctification. In Bonhoeffer's own life, he knew what that costly grace was. In his later writings, he moved further in exploring the implication of Christ for the church and living in the world. Costly discipleship called for living in the world, a denial of otherworldliness, which is a sign of weakness, or what might appear to many people in our tradition to be a contradiction in terms, the call is to worldly holiness. It is during this period of his life that some of his most popular catchphrases came to expression. He deplored the practice of attempting to find God at the fringes of our existence, of bringing God in to fill in the gaps in our knowledge, so that he is simply a God of the gaps. The time may come, and Bonhoeffer thought it had already arrived, when men could answer all their questions in ignorance. This situation was in mind when he coined a world come of age, or a world which has grown beyond religion. So instead of on the fringes, God is the beyond who must be in the midst of life, or as he put it in one place, the church stands at the center of the village. By religion, he was apparently thinking about a felt sense of need, an awareness of a dimension of our existence which can only be filled by the infinite. Some have misunderstood him to be referring to the trappings of religion, its ceremonies and other cultic activities, but his understanding goes much deeper than that. In this rejection of religion, he had the example of Karl Barth to follow, since Barth had argued that Christianity was not a religion, as religion was man seeking God, but Christianity was God seeking man. On this basis, he criticized Paul Tillich, who sought to find a point of contact for the Christian message in man's existential anxiety. The problem, Bonhoeffer claims, is that Tillich fails to see that men are no longer religious, so that any attempt to approach them through their religion is doomed to fail. This provides a terrific challenge to the church. What was his answer? It is found in another one of his famous formulas, Christianity without religion. In my opinion, Bonhoeffer's own experience led him to this grim conclusion, and I do not really think it is a viable one, since Christianity without religion would cease to be New Testament Christianity. A number of men have attempted to follow Bonhoeffer's suggestions here, however, and have come up with so-called secular versions of Christianity which have not experienced much success. Bonhoeffer's close friend and interpreter in America, Eberhard Bethge, insisted that Bonhoeffer was always moving on, and any one aspect of his theological work was an attempt to address a situation and balance out an overemphasis in another direction. Thus he warned against taking his suggestions too far, since to do so would distort Bonhoeffer's own intentions. But Bonhoeffer's final work was to seek to carry out the full implications of his incarnational theology as he understood it. He saw that the radical involvement of discipleship called for him to participate in the plot which led to his imprisonment and ultimate death. From out of prison, he spoke to tell the world that God and the Christian faith cannot henceforth bloom as a hothouse plant, protected from the godless world where man has come of age. The Christian is called by Christ to plunge himself into the life of this world, because that is what Christ himself did.
Thank you for listening to the Holiness Today podcast. If you enjoyed this production and wish to hear more, visit holinesstoday.org/podcast or find us on Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts.